Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Treasures from Malta podcast. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection, and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today may be Maltese, but he's truly a citizen of the world. He is an artist and an art historian whose studies have taken him from Africa to Australia, and he now resides and lectures in North America. He has become a specialist on African and modern European art, and he lectures at prestigious institutions and universities in and around Washington, D.C. But his heart lies in the modern period of Maltese art, and among his many, many published studies, he has produced two landmark publications that chart the rise of modernism in the visual arts in Malta. He has curated a number of important exhibitions and is an active artist who has exhibited widely. In 2019, he was awarded the Gold Medal of the Malta Society of Arts. Joseph Paul Kassar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Francesca, for this invitation.
Firstly, Joseph, where are you speaking to us from at the moment?
I'm talking from Baltimore, which is in Maryland, which is about 30 minutes drive from Washington, D.C., from the capital, that is.
And you're based there at the moment?
This is where I'm based. It's a university town, so there are many universities. You can be driving and you're actually passing on your right and on your left campuses of universities like Towson, Johns Hopkins, and others, Maryland University, in Notre Dame.
Very handy for you, because you lecture at all of these institutions, but we'll come to that later.
Yes.
But let's go back a few years, Joseph. Where did you grow up, and were you always making art as a child?
I was born in Pietà, and we lived in Cospicua for the very first 7 years of my life. We lived in Bull Street, quite a famous street in Cospicua. And I remember there is that big steep staircase where I used to play during those 7 years. They're very fresh in my mind. Mm-hmm. Our place had two main doors, one to a main street and the other one was down the steps on the side. And that side was very safe, so I could play there. There was no traffic, it's just pedestrian. Across from our house was the Society of Christian Doctrine, so that's where my parents used to send me for my religious training. As a kid, they had a big garden and a yard, so I used to play there. But what is something I remember is that this house had a cellar, where I remember my mom was still keeping, you know, vegetables to stay fresh there. But this was, in a way, my first studio, because it was my sanctuary, and I used to work there. I was always drawing, I was painting, I was playing with cars. This was my place. And eventually, after the 7 years, my parents decided to move to Hamrun, to Parish Priest Muscat Square, quite a central place in Hamrun, and a very big house. And eventually my parents, as they got older, they moved to St. Paul's Bay, where we had already a resort place where we passed all our summers, very close to the Giliru and the Sirens sports club there. And therefore I took the Hamrun house as my entire studio. The whole house became my studio. And I had many artists and friends who used to come and visit there until, of course, I moved out from Hamrun and eventually established my home and studio in Shamshila, as you know.
I see. I was going to ask you, were your parents supportive of your art? But this implies that they were very supportive if they gave you the run of the house in Hamrun as a studio.
They were supportive, my father in particular saw that I am very inclined, and I'm very grateful to him because I remember these years when I was still in Cospicua, 6 to 7 years old, that is, every Saturday he used to take me to Valletta, and he used to take me Republic Street, and we used to enter at the Museum of Archaeology, the main hall, where there was always an exhibition. So this would be the 60s and going, you know, a little early in the 70s. So the exhibitions I researched and wrote about, I actually saw them, but I vaguely remember. I wasn't understanding all these things at the time. But that was the disposition.
Yeah, what a formation.
So I'm so grateful that he did this. Then, of course, he would take me for cheesecakes and tea. So it was a great outing. This was something I would never miss. Every Saturday we did this. So there was encouragement. My mother also was encouraging, because when I developed my first studio, which was on the roof, this Hamrun house had a big roof, and somebody who lived there probably raised chickens, I think, up there. So that my father adapted and arranged it into a studio for me. And I worked a lot there. I had Antoine Camilleri coming there. I had Oliver Frigieri coming there in this room upstairs on the roof. And I worked a lot there. And eventually, of course, he saw that maybe I should go to the School of Arts. And that was his idea again, which I did from 1977 till 81, I believe.
So you went to the School of Art, and then after that, did you continue with your studies in, like, formal training in art?
Well, the School of Art was very important. Remember that generation of mine, 77 to 81, we were the last generation where we had artists like Gaspard Barthé, Harry Holden. I remember Samuel Bouget at some point came here. Even Vincent Appap came to run the school at some point. There was also Joseph Lawrence Malia. These are all people that I was all the time talking to and sharing ideas. So that was quite a very strong generation. Yes, it was very traditional. We didn't do anything modern. It was always still life painting, what have you. And the artists I was trained with that all took it seriously would be Alex Dalli, Ivan Grima, Lino Borch, Joseph Saliba of Orme. And I also remember Isabel Borch, who used to come. Next to me used to be Patrick Fenech, also, who is a very important artist sent into photography. I remember Rubianco attending there. So this was the generation we were at the time. Then, of course, I was interested in studying further. They were giving summer scholarships to the Academy Pietro Vannucci Perugia at the time. I went 2 times and I found it very useful. So then I started paying myself and continued for going for 4 years to the Accademia Pietro Vannucci in Perugia, where I met some other interesting artists like Bruno Murnari, who is a very important designer, Mancini. And I had already been to Perugia before, where I had met even Gerardo Dottori, one of the last futurist artists. After that, I decided I need to establish my own studio and start doing my own things. So
the training in Perugia was, again, quite traditional.
Strong
grounding in figure drawing and this sort of thing.
Mostly it was figure drawing, the nude, because we didn't have so much access in Malta still at the time.
Still.
Yes, at the time it was still a problematic, although we started then doing it by ourselves with Alfred Briffa, with Antoine Camilleri, with Giuseppe Caruana. And it was important because I learned the etching printing techniques there. So that was another important aspect.
You came back to Malta and you established yourself, very much so, I would say. By the 80s, you were teaching art and art history at the Malta Society of Arts. You were an art critic for the Daily News. But then, at one stage, you just gave it all up and you left for Africa. Now, tell me what prompted that decision and where you went in Africa, because we talk of Africa and African art, but really we should be specific about areas of Africa.
The African chapter is a very important chapter for me because, remember, I went, I believe, in September, October of 85. That's when I left Malta. And so many things happened that which are important for me as a person, not just for my art. In 81, I graduated from the University of Malta. I took the warrant to be a teacher. So I started teaching from 81, and by 85, I realized I have to get out and get some more experiences. So I left in 85. At the time, when I left, I was already involved in Malta together with Prof. John Rizzonaudi, who was the Chancellor of the University, and together with a friend of mine, a surgeon, Dr. Maria Meila from Tarshin. And we set up what we call a voluntary lay missionary society, known as VLM. This was situated at the missions office in Merchant Street in Valletta. There was no organization in Malta for sending lay missionaries abroad, Africa, India, Latin America, you name it. And we were the first, three of us, we established this organization.
I'm just going to stop you here. Why the interest? Because this takes off in a different direction. It's nothing to do with art, really. Did you have a calling to be a missionary? So,
well, I was more interested in adventure, to tell you the truth.
but that was more acceptable side of adventure.
This is how it got channeled, you see. Remember, before I went to Africa, I had already traveled a lot to India, where I met Mother Teresa and all of that. So there was this missionary spirit, but honestly, if I'm sincere, it was all adventure at this time. Anyway, we set up this organization. We get even approval and funding from Rome for it, which I do not believe they have anymore now. They have to fund themselves now because it's still in existence, this VLM. And I became its first secretary. And as soon as we had the funds to be able to send people abroad, I said, I'm the first one, I'm going to leave. So I left, you see. And and I left. My parents this time weren't too happy that I'm leaving because they said, you have a job here, you know. I had to do it. So I left. And I met some very interesting people in Africa. Like, for example, Sir Michael Wood, who was one of the founders of AMREF, the American Medical Research Foundation, which has to do with the flying doctors. And we traveled. We traveled to Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, Malawi, Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan. And that's where I started to learn Swahili and Somali, which became very important for me to integrate and to get to know the culture of the people.
So you're actually fluent in these languages, in Somali and Swahili?
Swahili are very fluent. Somali, not so much, because it is very complex language. In Somalia, I only spent 2 years there. And Somalia was a very difficult country. Remember, I was there when the civil war started, when they ousted the presidency at Barre. And I met there two very important, influential people, like the Bishop Salvatore Colombo, who was the bishop and lived in Somalia for over 40 years, who was the head of Caritas in Somalia. And I worked very closely with him. And on the day that I was also with him, he was actually shot and killed.
Oh, my goodness. In your presence? No.
No, but I was with him a few hours before, because he was actually shot in his garden, in his residence. And then I worked also with another important Italian, Annalena Tonelli, who also received the special award of the Nansen Refugee Award by UNHCR in 2003. Was also killed. So it was a very dangerous place, Somalia. In fact, I had to be evacuated in the end. And
let's take a step back. Tell me, when you arrived in Africa, where was it that you were based and what were you doing? What was the missionary work?
The first place I went was Sudan, and then I moved to Kenya soon after. And there I found myself discovering new roles, like, for example, agricultural projects, digging for wells, building a school. And then eventually I started to get into rehabilitation of disabled, which was with this organization that I will join. I will leave the Maltese VLM organization, and I joined a German international NGO, which is called Christoffel Blinde Mission. Today, more it is known as Christian Blind Mission International. It has offices in America, in Australia, in Germany, in different parts of the world. And they specialize in prevention of blindness. So I studied Braille. I became a mobility instructor. These were all done in Bensheim in Germany, which is very close to Frankfurt. And I could have easily made a career out of this. I mean, because we were very desirable by the World Health Organization, by UNHCR. In fact, I worked very closely with all these people and organizations. But at some point, Africa, as much as I loved it, exhausted me, and I was afraid I was getting sick. Mm-hmm. I thought I was getting malaria, but it wasn't. And that's why when I had to return, because I continued painting and I continued to be interested in art. So my desire was to come back and resume my studies.
Absolutely. In fact, I mean, although you were very much engaged in this missionary work you were doing, you were also absorbing art firsthand. I mean, and I recall this because you passed it on to us when you came back to Malta and you started lecturing the History of Art program. I was one of the undergrad students, and I remember that your knowledge of African art kept surfacing, even though we were doing units which were not directly related, like modern European art. Always this knowledge of African art surfaced, and you sort of wove it into the influences that made up modern art generally, which was really inspiring for us, because one tends to look always to the West when really we should have a much wider picture. You also brought artifacts back with you. So as you were traveling around Africa, you were actually acquiring knowledge, but also acquiring objects firsthand. You were getting them from the tribes, from the places that they were created. So in terms of authenticity, you can't get more authentic than that.
Yes. The issue is that in Africa, like we have in the case of Picasso or all the artists who actually used African masks in their works, etc., they were interested just in the outside, in the aesthetics of it. They had no interest and had no knowledge either of their value. Mm-hmm. In other words, what they were used for, or if there are any hidden meanings. And that's exactly what we were doing in the exhibition that we curate too. We were trying to understand that a mask has a spirit. And the spirit is because of the material it is made of. That's why we still say today, touch wood. Mm-hmm. It is coming from these kind of things, that they have some magical power in them. The Africans believe that the tool itself that is handed from father to son has magic powers in it, that the skill in the tool itself is transmitted when they are given to hand it over to somebody else.
You mentioned the exhibition. One of the opportunities you had given us was to assist in the curation of an exhibition on African art, which is probably one of the first exhibitions of African art that we had in Malta. And as students, of course, it gave us it gave us an experience in both curation and in handling these objects. So it was really, really a good experience for us.
That was at St. James Cavalier, as you remember. Yes. And that was the idea, that these are beautiful in our eyes, mm-hmm. definitely, but they are nonetheless objects of utility. The Africans create these objects for special purposes, for puberty, for weddings, for funerals, for all kinds of stages in life.
Yeah, rites of passage.
Yes, and therefore, once you speak to the people, once you start talking their language, this is how you get these meanings. Mm-hmm. And one of the prerogatives of studying African art, and maybe that's why it's not always so popular at times, is because it requires that you study it in the field. You cannot just study it from looking at the aesthetics in the museum, but you have to be there, you have to speak to the people, you have to see the rituals, you have to see the ceremony, you have to see the mask and the costume, you have to see it while there is the music being played and all of this.
That brings the anthropological dimension into it. You're almost an anthropologist because you're there with the people understanding all of this. What about the ethics of bringing these objects away? These are objects of veneration, much like perhaps a chalice in Christian art would be an object of veneration because something very special happens within a chalice. How do you handle that aspect of yes, I'm sure you've got complete respect for these objects, but the fact that you're taking them out and bringing them into a totally different context, into a Western context, is that something that challenged you in a way?
There are two aspects to that question. Number one is that the Africans have now realized, even in the remote villages, they realize there is a market for these things. So they want to sell it. If they see a white person, they call him the Muzungu. Muzungu means the foreigner. Who comes and is ready to pay to get them. I didn't fall in that category. I was literally living with these people from the different tribes that I was traveling and living. And therefore, I realized that that these objects, these statuettes, the masks, whatever I brought, Ethiopian crosses, etc., they had a shelf life. In other words, they had like an expiry date. They were used, and at some point, their function finished. They felt they had to replace it.
Magic dissipated. When they
realized that their power is diminishing, they throw them away. But they throw them with respect. With every village, there is always at the back a heap of rubbish that they throw away, which includes masks, which includes carvings. All the ones I have came from when they were thrown away. And for that reason, they leave them to rot naturally. At times they are slightly broken or what have you. So they were all, according to them, their function has finished because they are disposable. And that's where I actually acquire them. Of course, you still have to pay, you still have to talk to them, but they will willingly give it to you.
You've also traveled to places like India. You mentioned that you joined the missions in India as well. And you had a close encounter with Mother Teresa. Tell me about it.
Yes, India was where I thought I was going to work first. So it came before Africa. So I went there in 1980-81. I was still a student at university. And I used to go for the summer months for 3 months there. I managed to visit even the Santal Parganas, which is the mission by the Maltese Jesuits, very high up north. And then that's where I met Mother Teresa. I simply went to knock on her house and we developed a very close friendship between us. We exchanged letters. After that, I met her several times and I had two interesting episodes with her. One was in 1981, when she asked me to deliver the present for the wedding of Prince Charles and Diana. I'm the one who delivered it. Imagine if I go to Buckingham Palace today, they would arrest me, probably.
Are you serious? So she actually gave you an object to deliver?
Yes, yes. She had a frame in her room. She took me to her room. This actually happened in Rome, when I was still going to India, because she was having treatment in Rome. And it was a Sacred Heart of Jesus and Mary picture, typically Indian. Jesus and Mary were like Krishna, all in purple and psychedelic. It was absolutely terrible. She knew that I painted because I used to show her drawings. She told me, can you remove the picture from this glass frame? She signed it. I saw her writing it to Diana, to Charles, whatever. Then I put it back in. Then she brought a piece of brown paper, which was stained with oil, I believe, and put it like that. Then she had no tape. I remember she went down in her room and she got the lace of the tennis shoes and she tied it like that. She said, Joseph, take it to Buckingham Palace. I said, how can I take it to Buckingham Palace? Who will know me there? I said, don't worry, I will arrange everything for you. And anyway, I took it to London. They stopped me there. And so when I was telling them, obviously it took a while. Until
at Buckingham Palace. So you went to Buckingham Palace this scruffy present.
I never met Diana or Charles or anything, but somebody at some point came and I said, this is directly coming from the hands of Mother Teresa. They said, yes, and they took it.
Ironically, Mother Teresa and Princess Diana died within days of each other.
Correct, and they were very good friends, yes. And the other incident was done some years later with her too. I remember Joseph said, I have a mission for you. I said, what's that? She said, here are $400. I remember she gave me $400. And she told me, go to the bookshops. This was in Calcutta, in India. And she said, every book you see about me, buy it. And there were many books. Coffee table books with photos of photographers used to go and follow her and whatever. And I said, all this money, I cannot understand. Anyway, I had a man with me with a wheelbarrow. They were very heavy. I spent the money and took them back. She was in there when I took them back. And I don't know exactly what happened there. After months, I asked her that question.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, may I ask what is the purpose of this? And she told me, these people, if you open the books, many of them are saying they are done with proceeds that go to Mother Teresa. She said, none of these books have my permission. I don't know what action she took afterwards. I have no clue. But she wanted to make sure probably to follow this case that people were taking advantage of her society.
So Joseph, on returning to Malta in the 90s, you came back to teaching and you commenced a career in academia. You also continued studying at the same time. Over the next decade, you obtained two MAs in art-related subjects, one from an Australian and the other from an American university. And then you read for a PhD in art history and criticism from the University of Malta. It seems to me that you were zipping around the world collecting degrees.
Well, it seems like that, but it isn't. Remember that in 1977, when I entered the university, my choice was, although teaching for me is a vocation, it wasn't to apply to the Faculty of Education for a teaching course. I remember going to the administration office and asking them, I want to apply to study art history. They said, it doesn't exist. We do not have it. So I remember already saying, I would have to go abroad to do this. All right. Eventually, we will have the art unit with Prof. Mario Bohajar, as you know.
Of course, setting it up. He's the founding father of it.
And I remember being in Africa, my father telling me, come, there is this now at the university. There is the Art and Design Center in Valletta, which is always what you thought you can help in teaching. But then I had already left. So this, in a way, was how I thought I have to definitely go abroad and study to be able to specialize. And I am here specifically for professional reasons as well. So
absolutely. But in the early 2000s, actually, our paths first crossed in those years. I was reading for my undergrad in art history and you were lecturing modern art. But in your case, the connections with the University of Malta had actually started much earlier because you were involved in a students group called the KKU. And these were instrumental in starting up the university's own art collection. Can you tell us a bit about what happened
there?
Yes,
this is the Cooperativa Culturale Universitaria, the KKU. When I was teaching part-time at university, and I always remained part-time, I was very much involved in art exhibition organizations, cultural activities, and therefore Father Peter at the time told me, come become a member of the KKU.
Sorry, I'll interrupt you. This is Father Peter Saracino
Engloth,
was the rector at the time of the university.
And I started having these meetings and attending, and we started organizing a lot of exhibitions, which then I continued to do with the art unit, the famous one of Victor Diacono, for example, or George Fenech. These were very important exhibitions that we held. But I remember we had with the KKU a task of I came the idea of having artworks on campus, like all other universities have, and even possibly a museum. And I remember inviting artists to have works. I tried to secure them some money, at least expenses. I remember we had a piece by Giuseppe Caruana. I remember we had a piece by Vince Briffa. And unfortunately, these were all put in place. We had a lot of Gabriel Caruana, as you know. But there were some acts of violence, as you know, even the Gabriel Caruana ceramics, some of them were broken. And eventually these were removed. So it was very disappointing. Well, the biggest project with KKU was to put a mural posthumously of Victor Pasmore, which was meant to be at the entrance of the Faculty of Architecture. Everything, I had the cooperation of Professor Charles England at the time, who had the original design of it, and everything had permission from the family. And it came down to 2,000 lire at the time, I believe, which we couldn't find the 2,000 lire. And unfortunately, this work never happened. Which is
for what would have been an invaluable work of art. Victor Pasmore, of course.
Precisely. Precisely. You know.
Yeah. Victor Pasmore, of course, is the most important post-war abstract artist in Britain.
Yes.
He settled in Malta in the 60s and remained in Malta until his death. So,
yes,
in a way, we appropriated him ourselves. But we'll talk about him later.
Yes, yes.
Years later, you moved to the States, where you are now.
Baltimore, where I live, is a very good hub in the eastern part of America, because you have Washington just half an hour away. New York City is just 3 hours by car. So Virginia also has some very good musicians. So we are in an area where we have some very good cultural activities and museums. So,
but you're presently a professor of art history and appreciation at the University of Maryland. You're also a visiting professor in a number of other universities, such as Johns Hopkins University. And you also conduct courses for several institutions, including the Smithsonian, the New York Times. Now, how does an admittedly well-traveled art historian from Malta establish himself so well in American academia?
Well, I didn't plan this. This simply happened. I worked hard, of course, but I mean, there is no recipe of how to do something like this. When I came in the first years, of course, I had already come to lecture in America, so I had some contacts, but it was very, very difficult to reestablish yourself. First of all, to insert yourself in the system, all your qualifications, whatever you have, mm-hmm, it doesn't really matter. You have to prove they are what they call them U.S. equivalent. In other words, they have to be evaluated in New York City, where they tell you, fine, we recognize your degrees. I had no problem of this, but anyway, you have to pay, and this takes a couple of weeks to take place. And the second, which is more important, is that you have to prove yourself. So the first things I started was to knock on the doors of various institutions to offer them, in different programs that they had, morning, evenings, you name it, to lecture. And I was making a lot of proposals. Of course, no pay, no nothing. This was all for free. Mm-hmm. And I learned one big lesson, which I had no clue about it, which is that when you are lecturing here, you have no clue who's in the audience. This is a very big country. And I remember in one particular lecture, there were maybe 200 people in the audience, and there were people from the New York Times. So after I finished, they came on the stage there. They asked the director if they can speak to me. They said he's still there. I was drinking some water. They said, we're from the New York Times. We would like you to design some courses for us. We liked what we heard, and so on. Another occasion, I remember I had a full course, which was, what, maybe 20, 25 hours lectures through the several weeks on Pablo Picasso, based on the Museum of Picasso in Paris, the one in Barcelona, and the one in Antibes. Three museums, putting them together, where today I take my students to all of these museums. Anyway, and there was a man in the audience who attended the entire course, said nothing. And at one point he said, do you have some time? I remember it was already 8:30 in the evening. I said, well, I still have to go and drive home. He said, well, I can take you home to show you my seven Picassos. if you like. So I called my wife. I said, listen, today is going to be a very late night. I'm not coming.
You bet.
We became very good friends. We still meet. In fact, I had the opportunity to examine on several occasions this Picasso's in my hand, inside out, front and back. So you never know who's at the audience. Mm-hmm. And this is what connected me with museums, and today I'm simply invited to go to these places. I do not have to apply for anything. The Smithsonian was the same thing. They publish a magazine. Some people heard me and they said, why don't you lecture there? And so on. I said, I never thought of it. So I applied to this contact that they gave me. They asked me to go, and we talked and we started, and today I give them at least 8 courses per year or seminars, which means starting at 9 in the morning and they finish at 4:30 in the afternoon, and with just a break for lunch. So they're very, very demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And up to 300 people or more attend at times.
Joseph, during your time in Malta, you held a number of personal exhibitions of paintings, of your own paintings and drawings. Now, just to give, you know, to reduce it to a nutshell, but my assessment of your art, your line is particularly strong and it characterizes your figure studies and your portraits. But you've also worked quite extensively in abstract art, and here color becomes the subject of the works. In fact, I saw a particular body of work which is all about exploring color, and that resulted from your residency at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts.
Correct.
What are you presently working on, and are you represented by a gallery and exhibiting in the U.S.?
I continue focusing more on abstraction today, definitely. Although at times, you know, we are in a place and I meet a person and draw their face or something, but I'm interested in abstraction. I'm interested in the process of how I use the paint of the liquid runs. I like the surprise. I like that it is taking me on a journey. I have no clue where it's going to take me, although I have some plan. So I'm working into abstraction. Yes, I'm represented by a gallery here, which is called Y Art Gallery. So you go on their website and you find my name. You will see some of the works that are representing me there. I exhibited personal shows in the Columbia Art Center. I exhibited at the Scots Gallery. And I exhibit basically with all the faculty shows with all these universities. Remember, these universities have their own museums and galleries, very nice ones. And we have faculty shows, we have biennials.
Joseph, let's take a break and then we'll come back to find out more about your life in academia and in art. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, artist and art historian, Joseph Paul Cassar. Joseph, you were in touch with so many of Malta's modern and contemporary artists, and in fact, you've spent a lifetime viewing their art from when you were a child, but also collecting their exhibition brochures, press clippings, writing about them, reviewing these artists. You've researched the artists who established modern art in Malta, and you've published extensively about them. In fact, your 2-volume Pioneers of Modern Art in Malta have become the standard reference text for any student of modernism. Now, do you continue to research this area, even though you're now based abroad?
Since I'm abroad, I'm actually doing more research on more these arts, because unfortunately, when I was in Malta, I was teaching essentially from 8 in the morning or 8:30 till late in the evenings. I used to go to the Mediterranean Institute, remember, with Carmelo Vassallo. I was with the Faculty of Education. I was with the art unit. I was with the junior college. I had lectures even at the Faculty of Theology at some time. So it left me absolutely no time, and I really wanted a day or two where I could actually do my research. That's a possibility that I have here.
Mm-hmm.
And today, with the means of communication that we have, and of course with my regular visits to Malta, at least once a year. At times I come more than that. I continue. So I'm actually more involved.
Well, I can attest to this because in the preparatory meeting we had before the recording of this podcast, I thought I was bringing you up to speed about what exhibitions are on at the moment. And you seem to know of everything. I thought, wow, it's like he's actually in Malta seeing them. And it's true. The resources are there. I mean, we do have quite a lot of online resources. It's not the same as standing before the works, but
of course,
but it's helpful.
But there are no excuses. In fact, I talk to friends regularly, virtually, and at times I tell them, what is this that's happening there? And they wouldn't even know. They say, how come you are there and you're talking about it already? Because I do my best to follow these things. But of course, I miss the fact that I'm not there. At times I really wish I'm knocking on the door of a particular person and tell them, listen, I need this picture, I need this and the other. So I would have to wait or send somebody to do that for me. But the research continues. This is a never-ending thing. This is going to be my life mission. Volume 1 and Volume 2, I think will remain the most important thing I've ever written, in spite that I am engaged in some other important research now. But everything that I'm doing is actually coming from these two volumes. In other words, there are many lacuna, there are many gaps. There are artists that we need to focus on them and their times, and I continue to make deductions and research that are coming from there. So the research continues, obviously.
One of your landmark publications was the wonderful illustrated catalogue of an exhibition that you also curated, which was dedicated to the art of Carmelo Mangione in 2007. This exhibition was held in 2007. Carmelo Mangione, of course, was one of the leading figures of modern art in Malta. Now, you were in touch with most of the artists you wrote about. You practically remember even the first generation. You were in touch with the first generation of modern artists, although they were old at the time. Can you give us a flavor of what the art circles were like in the 70s? And was there a central figure that brought them together?
These artists, I knew them personally, okay? Mm-hmm. So I talked to them without any exception. Some I knew more than others, of course, like you're mentioning Carmelo Mangione. I didn't mix with him as much as many other artists. He was very much a recluse. He was very much working on his own, but it was quite a discovery to the study. I had the full cooperation of his wife and his daughter. And of course, I spent a lot of time in his studio to do all the research. There is an artist that I admire a lot, and we still need to explore, that is Joseph M. Borchwirep, who I remember, and I mentioned this in my volumes, that he said that he's afraid, now that he is old, that all these artists and the documentation we have about them is going to be forgotten. And that really struck me, because I said, we need to do something about it. And that's when I started to become their friends, collecting things, interviewing them over a 25-year period. The interviews were, and then approving them. Most of them have all, of course, passed on now. And I realized that I was running out of time. And I'm convinced today that if I didn't embark on that project, which I never thought I am the one that would have to do it. I thought somebody else would do it. But at some point I started to feel morally obliged that I have to do this because I was so much into it. I'm convinced that a lot of the information that we have in Volume 1 and 2 would have been completely lost because it was very hard for me to obtain certain things like the minutes of the meetings of both Modern Art Group, of Atelier, of the Artists Guild. I started to build the trust, and these people, before they died, they used to call me, come over for dinner, and then I would find piles and piles, if not boxes. They say, these are documents. When I was involved with photos, take them. You are the one who can do something with them.
So you've actually created an archive as well?
Yes, yes, which of course I want to, when I finish all these works, I want to hand it over to the National Archives, to our university in Malta, to places like that, Musa, whatever.
That's very commendable.
That's where it belongs in the end, but mm-hmm. I'm still working on them. Remember, mm-hmm. I have the original stuff, mm-hmm. minutes of meetings and photos, etc.
Now, this is what was happening in the 60s, the 70s, and I'll just bring you back to Victor Passmore, who we've mentioned. He settled in Malta in the 60s. Now, he was very avant-garde, considering what was happening in Malta at the time. His art is acknowledged and respected and considered extremely important worldwide. The art he created actually in Malta and his time in Malta is now in the Tate Gallery and other major galleries of modern art. And as an aside, I should say that Fondazione Patrimonio Malti manages the Victor Passmore collection of works for the Victor Passmore Foundation in Malta. And in fact, a permanent gallery is presently being set up by Patrimonio to house the collection and to share it with the public, so the visiting public will be able to see his art. Now, what are your memories of Victor Passmore? Because I do believe that you had contact with him. And secondly, to what degree was he influenced by Malta and the Maltese?
Victor Passmore, I had several occasions to meet him. Of course, what count most are the one-to-one conversations that I had. All I can say, he was a person who never was beating around the bush, was very direct, very much straight to the point. He hardly wanted to talk about his work. When I asked him very few words, he would tell you, he would say, well, look at it, it speaks for itself. He was extremely informed, very well read. And for that, in that respect of well read, as you know, the collection of books that he had at in Gugge, at Jamri, was donated to the University of Malta. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that happened, I went to study it. I went to see the list that the university was compiling. It wasn't even ready at the time. And I came up with some analysis of it, of how many are about Malta, how many are about Maltese artists, how many are about literature, how many are about philosophy of art. And I came up with a profile of it, which is all in the study I made of Victor Passmore in Malta, his legacy and influence on Maltese artists, which was partly a lecture at Patrimonio in the gallery of Victor Passmore that you have just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Regarding his influence, he always, and there are recorded videos on this and magazines, he always said that Malta never influenced him. In other words, there is no connection with Malta. Now, I can tell you from my experience and from experience of other artists, especially when you live in a different country and your roots are still from your country of birth, as in my case, Malta, you cannot remain indifferent to that new experience since you're living there. All right? So I have come across references to Malta, like the Blue Mediterranean, like the Maltese temples, that he was all the time talking about them. Even if you go to his garden, he had erected some semicircular walls, which are actually emanating the Maltese temples. He also has work specifically on Calypso, for example, and things like that. So definitely there is some connection, yet maybe not as obvious, but definitely he must have loved the sun. He must have loved that farmhouse in Gugge because it was a haven for him and he produced some of his more important works.
About his connection with the Maltese, with Maltese artists? Was he deeply involved in Maltese art circles?
Even that is a tricky question because he admired Maltese artists, at least some of them. In fact, he collected their works, and I have a list of the collection that he had and made studies on them. There was Cremona, for example, from
Cremona, Gabriel Carbona.
Broken glass series. He had an excellent painting of Alfred Kirchhoff. He had Luciano Micallef. He had the famous Josef Calleja. He loved Josef Calleja. There is a lot of correspondence that I studied when I did Josef Calleja research. there are letters between the two. Gabriel Caruana, as you said, Antoine, Caesar at Tart. So he collected, I'm sorry if I'm leaving somebody out, because he really followed all these artists. He used to go and see the exhibitions. He wasn't keen on attending the exhibition openings and mixing with artists as much. In that respect, he was more reserved. In fact, I have a collection of letters, as I said, of correspondence, where he says, well, I better not do this, better another Maltese critic will do this. So he was a little bit reluctant, but he has an intimate, strong connection with Maltese artists.
Yes. Joseph, in 2001, you curated an exhibition on the Passmore family. So
yes,
this was a landmark exhibition because it didn't just show Victor Passmore, but it showed his really immediate intimate family circle. And you familiarized us with the art of his wife, Wendy Blood, who was an important artist in her own right. But she was perhaps overshadowed by the more important Victor, at least the more famous
yes,
Victor.
Yes.
And of course, their photographer son, John Passmore.
Yes.
So that was an exhibition that was in the newly opened St. James Cavalier, and it gave us an opportunity
yes.
to meet the Passmores.
It was an important exhibition because it was, at least at that time, definitely the first time that the whole family was brought together. Maybe there was something like that after. Well, definitely it was the first. The works of Victor, we had to bring them from Marlborough Gallery in London. The ones of Wendy were coming directly from the Royal Academy, and John brought his photographs himself because he regularly visited Malta.
Joseph, speaking about women being overshadowed by male artists, all studies on the initial decades of modern art in Malta are entirely dominated by male artists. Where were the women?
Very unfortunate, yes. There are many historical reasons for all of this. I can tell you what I have discovered and what I have done. You know, for example, there is a certain Marika Li Corleo who was, I've seen a number of works and private collections of her, who was extremely, extremely gifted. Corleo is her maiden name, and then she married into the Cali family. But we do not see anything particularly modern coming out, but very, very gifted. So, given my research, the only way to discover many of these names was where the men came from, which was the School of Art archives. Mm-hmm. And these I have investigated together with my colleague Lino Borch. And I can tell you that from the 1927 until 51, I don't want to go after 51 because then we come into more obvious modern period, there were registered in the school throughout this period 113 female students. 113. That's a big number.
That's a big number. Did they all disappear?
Lucy Cicluna, Ines Soller, Mary Tufinio, Carmela Chantar, Maria Bonici Testaferrata, Meca Zolani. And they have their addresses. And when they started to attend and when they finished, although when they finished is a little bit of a question mark because they're not very reliable, the sources. I also came across a particular name from 1933, who seemed to be very gifted and where I found quite a few examples of her work, by the name of Antoinette Camilleri. She used to live in Old Bakery Street in Valletta, attending the school in 1932-1933. And to tell you the truth, they were so good that I mistook them for Antoine Camilleri because they are beautiful flowers and portraits and studies of the figures that she did in his period when he was already with free brush strokes, very impressionistic, until I zoomed on the signature and started to realize that she is Antoinette. I also interviewed Mary Inglot at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the interview, the highlight was that she told me very clearly it was unthinkable in the given social environment for a female student to go and study abroad alone. And for that reason, I never found the name of one of these women artists who attended the school, who even competed for the examination. So obviously they couldn't even continue to excel and compete with the men.
Was there no rebel amongst them? Wasn't there the one woman, at least the one woman, who who decided to buck the trend, who decided not to go along with the patriarchy, what the patriarchy was saying, and who said, no, I'm going to do my own thing. I need to be an artist. None of them.
What we have to do is, now that I have a list of names, we have to see if what work we can find of these people, which is tricky, and they must be in private hands for sure. Yeah. And to what extent they continue to paint, or whether they simply stopped, which is many times the case. Yeah. So that's where I am. What I can tell you also, in the book I published of Louis Vert and Helen Cavarra, Helen Cavarra is a typical student from the 40s who attended the school and eventually met her husband and they got married. And she was one who started painting like anybody else at the School of Art, but then branched into botanical drawings in watercolor. And she joined the Natural History Society at the time of Guido Lanfranco as president. And between 1973 and 78, I have identified that she did 368 indigenous flowers from Malta in watercolor. She left, I found out, some 18, which are still unfinished, so that makes it a total of 886, which in my opinion are very important and should be at least on loan at the Natural History Museum. These are documented in my publications, but that's where we are so far.
Okay, so your work is cut out for you, Joseph. That will have to be volume 3, I'm afraid. Get cracking on it. Joseph, in the year 2000, St. James Cavalier Center for Creativity, which now operates under the name of Spazio Creative, opened in Valletta. Now, the inaugural exhibition was entitled Art in Malta Today, and it was a survey of works of 60 modern and contemporary artists who were active in Malta at that time. You were then in charge of the visual arts program, and you curated the exhibition. What was your vision for the visual arts at the time? And has it been achieved now in the year 2023, looking back? Do you think that that box has been ticked?
When I was asked to be a board member in charge of visual arts for St. James Cavalier, which is from 2000 to 2003, that's when I served, the idea was, or my vision that I promoted to the board, was to promote art in Malta in all its aspects and forms. In other words, all the genres, doesn't matter, so long it is valid, so long it's represented what's happening in Malta. So it was an opportunity, the kind of program I was promoting, to re-examine continuously where we stand and where we are heading. This was the idea. So it was an idea of creating a very healthy balance of all these artistic manifestations, both by Maltese and even by foreign exhibitions. In fact, we had several important foreign exhibitions. To this end, I was instrumental in starting the program for the VCCA, for the Artists in Residence, with the Virginia Center for Creative Arts, which incorporated painters, writers, musicians, architects, and in return, Maltese had the opportunity to go and have this experience. Also, another vision I had was to start documentation. In other words, publishing. Every exhibition is documented properly, because this is what I was finding lacking from the past, which was very difficult to bridge together. So every exhibition between 2000 and 2003 are all documented with a catalog. It's not just a piece of paper. It has good photography. It is articles. It's also at times a publication, which of course demanded a network of collaboration of how to sponsor these things and so on. Has it been achieved? Well, this is an ongoing thing. You never achieve it. Although I think we can see the fruits of all this activity, not only from 2003, even from the years that came after. About what's happening today. We're seeing new blood coming, which is giving more energy to the visual arts in Malta, including its diversity. And this is very important. So in this field, I find out you cannot say, I climbed the mountain, I'm at the top, I can rest, I am happy, I've achieved my... No, when you are at the top, you will see another mountain with a higher top, and you start all over again. So this is how it goes. And I think we have to continue I was going to say start. We have to continue to take art very seriously, because this is something that really represents who we are and what we can do. And to tell you the truth, this is what I'm promoting while I'm here in America. I have given courses on Maltese art, trying to put them on a more universal international platform.
So, Joseph, on that very positive and very uplifting and forward-looking note, I'm going to close off the podcast. I have to tell you, thank you not only for giving us your art, but also for sharing the beauty of the art of other countries and for taking Maltese art abroad.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website.